Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our very special guest is Samuel Hulick, the master and guru of user onboarding, the author of The Elements of User Onboarding. But surprisingly, we're going to talk about a different topic today, which is UX personalization. This episode is brought to you by Feedier. Sick and tired of non-valuable customer feedback? Meet Feedier, the next-generation feedback application. Understanding your rewarded and empowered customers starts now. No more time-wasting service. They win, you win. Sign up for your free plan at feedier.com/UIbreakfast and get your first 3 months free on the standard plan if you decide to upgrade. That's feedier.com/UIbreakfast. Hi, Samuel.
Hello, Jane.
Well, thank you so much for making time for us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're going to start with a short blitz questionnaire to learn more about you personally and maybe a little bit about user onboarding. And then we're going to continue with the main topic. How does that sound?
That sounds good to me.
So question number one is, what do you do for a living?
For a living, I run a website called useronboard.com, wherein I review and critique popular web apps and mobile apps onboarding experiences, and also do consulting and education around that.
Wonderful.
Onboarding, not around the teardowns.
Mm-hmm. How did you get there? What's your background story?
I guess it depends on how much of the scenic route you would like me to respond with. But in lightning round kind of fashion, I have a user experience background and also a customer success background, and found that a lot of times customers or new users were slipping through the cracks, especially at sign up, and wanted to do something about it, and realized that there wasn't a whole lot of information about it when I started and looked to rectify that.
Wonderful. So is that how you picked your niche? How long ago was that?
That was about, like, that was, I think, 4.5 years ago. It does not feel like that long, but I think it was about that long ago.
And you've been reaping the benefits ever since, because you're number one go-to person when it comes to user onboarding.
Yeah, it turns out if you focus small enough on something, you can be the number one person.
Yeah, definitely. What does your typical day look like?
Oh man, I would say that I don't have a typical day, even for, like, in a professional routine kind of way.
But I mean, what kind of activities do you usually do for your clients? And typically, do you spend most of your time on calls, wireframing, doing teardowns that you publish regularly?
Oh, I see. Most of the consulting work that I do is in a review or like a heuristic analysis kind of capacity, just taking a look at someone's onboarding experience and pointing out areas that look like they could be good opportunities to run some experiments and see if things could be improved there, or areas that look like they're probably performing well as well. So that's a fair amount of the time that I contribute in a professional sort of way. And then beyond that, it's a lot of researching different topics like UX personalization and things like that, and also just looking to improve user onboard itself and hopefully have that have quality onboarding on its own as well.
Wonderful. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I honestly really, as a human being, I really love learning almost more than anything else. And I have found that that's definitely true in my career as well. And so that's something that I really like the most. And the parts that I don't like to do are almost in service of me just continuing to be able to do that. But then that said, the parts that I don't like to do, you know, outside of like administrative tasks that most people don't enjoy, like the tedium of it and things like that. Other than that, I'm pretty much into the whole thing. So I run a one person consultancy. So if I don't like my job, I should talk to my boss about that, I guess.
Right, and we know who that is.
Right.
What is your next big thing?
My next big thing right now is, I sort of alluded to it a second ago, but I did a cold hard look at the way that user onboard, the web entity itself, was performing, and realized that I was being really hypocritical when it came to to investing in the sort of onboarding patterns and principles that I espouse and champion all the time on my own product, which is like deeply hypocritical. And so I just started a few months ago putting in some infrastructure in place, and from here onward I'll be running a lot of experiments with things like lifecycle emails and empty states and progression systems on the user onboard web property itself, and looking to share the findings that come from those experiments.
Oh, that's wonderful. You must have a pretty amazing audience to make all the tests quite significant by now, right?
I should hope so, yeah. It's never quite fast enough, but I think I have enough to play with at least, yeah.
Wonderful. So before we get started on UX personalization, for those people who've been waiting for you to come on this podcast and talk about onboarding, we should probably send them over to your website and the book, because both are amazing resources to get started there. And you have a number of links to articles which are entirely free from your website.
Also correct, yep.
Mm-hmm. So UX personalization is a pretty popular word, personalization, that is. We're going to be having Brennan Dunn coming on here someday soon to talk about web personalization. But I'm hoping to get your take on web app internals and what's happening behind that login curtain with the user and what we can do there. What is UX personalization in your opinion? What is the definition?
I would say that UX personalization, and I would also like to be clear, like speaking of Brennan Dunn and his work, I have been following him for a very long time, but I've been especially interested in what he's been talking about as far as web personalization and opportunities to create a more convenient experience for people based off of information that may not be... is not often used by conventionally, I guess. And that's what's really opened my eyes in a big way. So I'm pretty early into this whole learning journey myself, but also very much inspired by Brennan. So I will be excited to hear that interview also. All of that said, to my mind, the essence of UX personalization to me is leveraging everything that you can to better understand the context that that someone is bringing to the use of their product at any given moment, and creating a sensible environment for them to accomplish what they're setting out to do by clearing that way and clearing that pathway as much as possible.
Do you think that can have some drawbacks? Because we might be depriving people of the full functionality of the product while we are, you know, directing them towards one path that we assume is the most suitable at the correct moment.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you assume, like the saying, right? Like, you know, there's a chance that you're getting it wrong. And so you don't want to design something in such a fashion that it's completely inescapable and you're just railroading someone through a process that perhaps they don't even want to be in. And you definitely want to build in that sort of flexibility for them to be able to kind of choose their own adventure. But at the same time, I think that I don't know if this sounds corny or not, but like once Brennan opened my eyes to this whole concept, I just started seeing things everywhere. One example he likes to point out is, why would you send someone a link in an email and then on the screen that is behind that link have an email sign up form? Like, you know that they don't need to see that. So there are ways to shape an experience or at least what you're presenting without with some pretty good bets at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Next question is somewhat related to user onboarding. I think you probably have seen multiple products in your practice that have multiple use cases or several audiences, even though that's not highly recommended from the product standpoint. But yet, oh, how do you branch those users from the very first steps that they're taking in your app?
Branch them, like segment that, like separate them, or
yes,
bring them together?
Do you just ask them down straight away what they came here to do, or are there any wiser choices you can make?
Yeah, well, and I think you're putting your finger on a really important concept. For me, at least as far as my understanding of UX personalization is that it's much more about understanding what the person is doing than it is about who the person is. And that's something that has really rubbed me the wrong way ever since I started in user experience design, where there's sort of the sacred cow of personas and you know, you work with stakeholders at companies and build up these sort of profiles of, like, John is 28 and drives a Kia and has two dogs and went to college at such and such and is uncomfortable around new technology, or all of these sort of personal characteristics or attributes that don't necessarily have a really causal relationship with what it is that they're trying to do in that given moment, or at least don't necessarily have that. Where on the other hand, if you focus more on what someone's trying to accomplish and look at the situations that drive that desire for accomplishment, that to me is much more causal and much more predictable and something that you can design more thoughtfully around. And so even though personalization has the word person in it, to me it's actually kind of more like situationalism, where you're understanding the context of the situation that someone's in and helping see them through that rather than trying to understand that person like as an individual necessarily.
That's a wonderful, wonderful point, but Us as listeners would love to have an example now to hear exactly how that can translate to real life web apps.
Sure. So one thing, and this is a little bit from an onboarding perspective, one thing that I often see when you're talking about trying to segment users early in the sign up process is asking, you know, like, let's say it's like SaaS oriented software. And as part of the sign up process, you ask, are you a designer, a marketer, an engineer, or other? And someone can, you know, in theory, select one of those and then be treated differently based off of that information. Maybe the interface is rearranged to highlight the different things that someone in one of those job titles probably cares about, or things along those lines. And that's something, even before I was really excited about learning more about UX personalization, something that I recommended against doing, even just from the user's perspective. Like me personally, when I've encountered those in my day-to-day life, I've always noticed that I have this momentary like, oh, why I have to try to sort of reverse engineer why I'm being asked that question. Like, how will I be treated differently based off of the answer? Because personally for me, designer, marketer, engineer are all three things that I could be at any given time. And so it's I have to sort of understand what will be different or what they'll be assuming about me based off of which answer I provide. And I think most people have that sort of momentary confusion or anxiety around that sort of question. Whereas if instead you're saying, what are the things you're trying to do? And even if you were to ask those people point blank, that's something that I think they can give you a much more concrete answer around, especially if you're asking them about like what they're trying to do in the moment, like at that given time. And it also just speaks to something that's more task oriented and accomplishment oriented by nature.
That's great advice. So ultimately, long story short, it's much easier for people to self-identify with what they want to do rather than trying to qualify themselves with some role, which is never binary or very strict.
Yes, I like your summary of it better than my rambling answer, but yes, exactly.
You went into wonderful detail anyways. Thank you. How about filling applications with sample content in regards to those functions that they picked?
I'm not sure what you mean by sample content necessarily.
So some kind of placeholder data that can be different based on whatever they came in there to do.
That can be kind of tricky on its own way, and again, I'm speaking more from an onboarding perspective here, but mm-hmm. I've also found that when I encounter mocked up data inside a product, it can be hard to sort of mentally differentiate between Is this just purely an example? Is this representing something more meaningful that has to do with me? If I go in and start creating quote-unquote real data, will it replace this or live next to it? Do I have to go in and delete the fake data? It can be a little bit confusing. And if you unpack the presumed intent of creating that dummy data, I think a lot of times it's just to show off what the product looks like when it's fully set up. And to my mind, that's something that can be achieved even more effectively before someone signs up and create promotional materials around that, where you maybe you have like an interactive demo or something, but make that open to the public. And therefore, there you get to show it to a wider audience, but also reduce that confusion once someone has signed up for real. I know a product like Josh Pigford's Barometrics has the transparent companies and the live demo of their own financial metrics and things like that. So those, I think, are great examples and sort of counterexamples to the dummy data in the app after you signed up pattern.
Oh, great. I was thinking you're going to say the best way of doing that is actually making the user use the product ultimately.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, you would rather have legit data than dummy data regardless. So yes, agreed on that one too.
So for UX personalization, let's continue with that context of specific actions that we can provide. Does that mean we could make some pre-made selections when the user is doing something? Does that make we can take them to specific points in the app when they just type it in the browser? Which is a big pain point for me because it's always trouble to even get to the homepage sometimes, not to mention the context.
I mean, one thing that you learn, or I would imagine most people would learn early in their familiarity with user experience design period, is the idea of setting sensible defaults, where if you are providing people with a list of options, is there one that you can pre-select as the reasonable assumption of what they will probably choose, and thus liberate them from the work of having to select that radio option? Or one example that I use a lot is the country picker. If you're making someone confirm which country they're in, this sort of nightmare example would be just 280 countries listed in a drop-down menu, and you, regardless of where you are in the world, the first ones are like Azerbaijan, and you have to make your way all the way down to United States in my case. And then there's sort of like the privilege of living in the U.S., where a lot of times maybe that one will be put at the top regardless, which is kind of better. It's more convenient. But even still, there's a lot that you can do with just taking the IP address of the person who's, operating that particular visit, and just find out which part of the world that they're in, and make that the pre-selected option that they can go in and override if they want to. But again, that would be a very good example of sort of UX 101 level sensible defaults, but also very much in like the UX personalization playbook as I understand it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on the tangent that I'm also going to ask Brandon about. How about GDPR and personalization? Do you think those two are kind of conflicting? When do people really want to be explored so that they can be better served? But better, probably web apps are a little bit better because they're up to sign up.
Yeah, web apps are after sign up. Although for me, like, that's again kind of a big part of, especially looking at the onboarding experience and how that's sort of a little bit of like shades of gray between pre sign up and post sign up anyway. Looking at making that one big continuous experience that feels more seamless and more custom tailored for people, whether they've signed up, whether they've gone past the account creation process or not, I think is a really good thing to keep in mind. So I wouldn't draw a super hard distinction between pre and post sign up anyway, but where it does come into play with like the GDPR and things like that, I will definitely say I'm not being humble when I say that I am really hoping that people with a much stronger legal background will be able to sort of present that in a more digestible way. There's a lot of confusion out there around what that means that sites can and can't do, and what sort of risk they're exposing themselves to, and whether that the law is how enforceable it is, and all kinds of different logistical and practical concerns in that sense. But underlying that, and pursuant to the question that you just asked, it's also an ethical question, which is, do you do some things that people aren't necessarily aware of and therefore aren't necessarily consenting to in order to better serve them? And I think that's a really, really legitimate ethical question, and something that I'm excited to be learning more about myself and navigating, you know, as best as I can according to my own principles. It's something where just having a UX background years ago, early on, like a decade ago, I realized that it's really not cliche to say that design is really powerful and that it really affects the world and people around us. And that's something that you want to wield responsibly. And for me, I kind of came up with my own Hippocratic oath, which was to always feel like what I was doing was legitimately to the benefit of the person receiving it. And I have stuck by that throughout my career and plan to continue to do so, even if we're getting into a terrain that freaks people out a little bit, I guess, is kind of the straightforward way of putting it.
That's a wonderful, honest answer. Thank you, Samuel.
Yeah. Do you mind if I turn around on you and ask if you have any takes on it?
If I were to put my take, it would be no better than yours, definitely. Well, I think the ethical side of things is definitely dominating. And I just recently read an article about publishers and GDPR that puts things quite a bit into plain English. And I'm going to link to that in the show notes so our listeners can also explore it. But generally speaking, yes, I think serving the user is a big purpose, and you don't really want to collect the data or do anything to compromise that relationship. That's probably the trust issue is number one for me. So let's imagine a practical situation. You as a consultant have taken up 5 projects, and all of them are relevant to UX personalization. So every founder came into you saying, we would love to do something in that direction to improve our user experience. What would the common procedures be? What would the common approaches be to typical web apps? I know they're all different. That's the main thing. But what can founders do in general? What's the direction they can take there?
To start implementing UX personalization practices on their own software?
Absolutely.
You know, I honestly don't have a great answer for that one. That it's something that I'm beginning to really just sketch out on my own, and I'm definitely not yet prepared to hang out my shingle as far as being in a UX personalization consultant or anything along those lines. But one thing that I've been thinking a lot about goes back to what we were talking about before, about focusing less on the person and more on the situation. I think that that's a really healthy practice for anyone to take on, is to just think about beyond use cases, because use cases are very easy to sort of make convenient for you, where it's like, oh, the use case for this feature is to use the feature, or the use case for this email list is to be on the email list, or things like that, where the situations are always by definition driven by some sort of and I really hesitate to use this term, but real world emotional sort of motivation in someone's life, that they're encountering a situation very similar to like the concept of jobs to be done, which I know you've had has been covered on this podcast before. But there's something surrounding that person where there are forces in their life that are kind of impelling them to move forward in a particular way, and my entire philosophy on user experience design and probably just design in general really hinges on the fact that that motivation that someone has from that's kind of, you know, that being impelled by their situation is really the only fuel that's driving the ensuing experience that might take place within your software to some degree. And so trying to, as best as you can, understand the what I call the unresolved situation is the situation that someone finds themselves in where they feel a need to act in a particular way. And so understanding that unresolved situation as much as possible so that you can most reliably guide people to a successful situation is, to my mind, the name of the game in software design, period. And I think UX personalization does a really good job of highlighting the best practices along that sort of line of thinking.
That's a great answer. How far can we go in mutilating sort of the essence of the app and trying to fit it to a particular use case? Not a use case, but the target, as you described.
Yeah, how far can we go? Like, what does the research process look like, or what does the post research design process look like, or?
I guess both would be great. My question though was how far can we deviate in our assumptions and hide something or do some presets in order not to offend the user or something like that.
Right. Yeah. So you don't want to like turn it into like the Fisher Price My First software or app or whatever kind of level of ease, because then you're removing a lot of the useful and powerful complexity from a product. But let's see, at the same time, I do really believe in the I'm trying to think of how best to describe it. The one sort of thing that comes to mind is I play Mario Kart with my kid a fair amount, and I'm not sure if that's something you're super familiar with or if you're listeners, but on the track you race these little go-karts around, and on the track there are sometimes these little speed boost patches where if you drive over them you go a lot faster for a minute. And in a similar way, I think that, if you identify the unresolved situation in someone's life and want to help propel them forward, you can kind of create those little boost areas as well. And ideally, if you can be taking all of the work off of someone's plate and just fast forwarding them directly to where they want to be, then so long as you're right, which is kind of the thing that we keep coming back to, like so long as you are really thoroughly understanding it and you are making a very good bet that what you're skipping people right to is indeed where they want to be, then ultimately you're really liberating them from a lot of emotional work, mental work, possibly physical work, whatever that might be. And examples that I see of this out in the wild are like Medium with its highlight to tweet the quote functionality, where you highlight the words in a Medium article and then it just tees you right up to tweet it from there. If you think about all the steps that you'd have to go through as far as highlighting it and taking or to do it manually, like you would highlight it, take a screenshot, go find the screenshot, pull up Twitter, compose a new tweet, drag the screenshot into the tweet text area, upload it, send it, and then go back to the article. That's a lot of steps. And instead, they just fast forward you directly to the getting the tweet highlight out there by creating the screenshot for you, creating the link of the original source, packaging that all up, all within Medium. You don't even have to leave it to go to Twitter and then come back. And so, or another example that I see is like in the Gmail app, mobile app, where if someone sends you an email, it will, I guess, parse the email for the general, I don't know what the word would be, intent, the substance of the email, and then tee you up with little auto response buttons at the bottom. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Oh, I guess iOS has those as defaults, but not as smart as Gmail.
Oh, I've only ever seen it in Gmail. So there's like the texting, like the one word at a time in messages and things like that. But at least for me in Gmail on my iPhone, there will be like three messages auto-populated at the bottom, which is like, okay, good to know, or yep, see you then, or things like that. And so instead of having to like tap reply, type out the message, send it, it just fast forwards you directly to what could be considered a very sensible default. But then it also is accomplishing that by doing some things that maybe people would be uncomfortable with if they really understood what was happening under the hood,
Absolutely. I must confess, I'm not using Gmail mobile app because they keep putting Russian timestamps on my mail. And there is no way to customize that. So that kind of trumps any other UX wins they have.
What is a Russian timestamp? Do you like a 24-hour day there? Or?
It just says, you know, this email was sent, like a typical email would append your previous email with a line. Like, this email was sent at this date by this person, etc. And it usually is in English if you go from web app, but the mobile app belongs to Russian App Store. Therefore, it puts Russian timestamps, scaring my clients to death, I think, with some Cyrillic characters.
That's a great example of UX personalization gone wrong.
Yeah, and this IP selection is quite often a nightmare because that's not what I want, but I'm probably not a typical user because I do not adhere to my native land. I work with foreign clients.
Yeah.
So, and there is one website that never remembers my choice, which is probably another pet peeve. So, Samuel, you mentioned you like exploring and reading and learning. Is there any recommended reading on the topic? Maybe something you've written or something other people have written on UX personalization?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've brought up Brendan Dunn a number of times, and as far as the article that really kicked this sort of perspective off for me, and I have gone back and read it and reread it like literally maybe 10 times, and it's pretty long, but that's just the level of my endorsement, is the article that he wrote about a year ago called The Anatomy of a Six-Figure Email Course, or something very similar to that title. I'm sure you can link it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that by any chance?
No, and I'm all ears.
Oh, okay. So that was sort of the first thing that I came across of his that really just even opened my eyes to the potential of personalization, and especially pre-account creation personalization, what he was able to accomplish with just getting someone's email address and being able to deliver valuable educational content to them, but in a way that was customized for them. And then it done it in an iterative way where it became even more customized based off of their response to the material that was being sent. I thought it was, you know, really just extremely intelligent and was practicing on a level of design that most designers I'm aware of are kind of like what the design zeitgeist was seeming to not even really take into consideration. And so that was where that whole notion started for me and how I sort of wound up being so interested in it even now.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you for the link. Well, Samuel, I hope we will see more writing and more speaking from you on this topic. But meanwhile, can you please tell us, our listeners, where can people find you and your work online?
Sure thing. Yeah, everything of importance that I do professionally is done through useronboard.com. There you'll be able to see some what I call teardowns, which are slideshow reviews of popular web app onboarding experiences. And then, as you mentioned, also some writing and speaking and things along those lines.
Amazing. Well, Samuel, thank you so much for opening up this this new topic with us today and volunteering to talk about it. And thank you for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you so much for having me on here. And thank you for sharing your wisdom as well.
Hope you have a great day.
You too.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.